Akko said. I never knew her. Lazmet came closer still and then lunged. Akos was ready for it, had expected it since he saw the man against the wall. But he wasn't ready for how fast Lazmet was. Grabbing him and twisting so hard Akos had no choice but to release the blade, Akos's training kicked in, and he fainted, pretending at weakness while swinging a fist at Lazmet's side. Lazmet grunted, his grip still hard around Akos's wrist, and Akos kicked him hard in the knee. Lazmet let go of him then, stumbling a little, but not enough. He surged up and forward, slamming Akos into the wall with the current blade at his throat. Akos froze. He was pretty sure Lazmet wouldn't kill him, at least not until he heard an explanation. But that was no guarantee that he wouldn't carve Akos up in the meantime. It's a shame you didn't know her. She was quite a woman, Lazmet said casually. He lifted his free hand and ran his fingertip down the side of Akos's nose onto his cheekbone. You look like me, Lazmet said. Tall, but not broad enough with these accursed freckles. What color are your eyes? Gray, Akos said, and he felt compelled to add sir to the end, though he wasn't sure why. Maybe it had to do with the knife at his throat and the substantial strength of the man pressing him to the wall. It seemed to hum in Lazmet's bones like a piece of the current itself. That would be my mother's side of the family, Lazmet said. Her uncle wrote love poems about my aunt's stormy eyes. My mother killed them both. But I'm sure you've heard that story already. I understand it's a popular one in Shotet. I've heard it mentioned. Akos fought to keep his voice steady. Lazmet released him, but didn't go far, so Akos couldn't make a dive for the weapon on the floor. Do you know if my son is dead? Lazmet said. He quirked his eyebrows. I suppose I mean my other son. Yes. He's dead, Akos said. His body is in space. A decent enough burial, I suppose. Lazmet spun his blade again. And did you come to kill me? It would be in the grand tradition of our family, you see. My mother killed her siblings. My supposed daughter killed her brother. My firstborn son lacked the stomach for killing me in the end. He was content to trap me in a cell for over 10 seasons instead. But you wear some marks. So perhaps you are not so weak-willed. Akos clapped his hand around his wrist to cover up the kill marks there. It was an instinct that seemed to confuse Lazmet, who tilted his head at the sight. Akos wasn't sure what the answer was anymore. He knew Lazmet needed to die, based on the way Syra reacted to the sight of him alone and everything he'd heard since then. But he hadn't been sure, deep down, if he could do it or not. He still wasn't sure. Regardless, he wasn't about to admit that to Lazmet. No, Akos said. I didn't come to kill you. Then why did you come? Lazmet said. You took great risks to do so. I assume you have a reason. You're the last blood relative I have left, Akos said. Is that a reason? It's a stupid one, if it is, Lazmet said. What is blood, exactly? Just a substance like water or stardust. It's more than that to me, Akos said. It's this language. It's fate. Ah, Lazmet smiled. His smile had a wickedness to it. So now you know that little Syra's painfully boring fate actually belongs to you. The second child of the family Noavek will cross the divide. His eyebrow arched. And you, I assume, as a born Shotet, have never been across the stretch of feathergrass that separates us from our Thuvazit enemies. Lazmet was analyzing him, making assumptions. They were incorrect, but Akos saw no need to correct him. Not yet, anyway. The less Lazmet knew about him, the better. Lazmet went on. You speak with the diction of someone who is low status. Perhaps you think I will send you to Thuva with my army for some higher purpose, that I will elevate you beyond your grasp. Akos kept his expression neutral. Though the idea of marching into Thuva and waging war just to attain a higher social status sickened him. Whether I help you with that or not depends, I suppose, on whether you are worth anything to me or not, Lazmet said. I know that you can kill, which is encouraging. You can't imagine how difficult it was to train Rizek to take lives. He threw up after the first time. Disgusting. And my wife forbade me from attempting the same with Syra, though I hear she had a greater capacity for it in the end. Akos blinked at him. What did you say to a man who was deciding whether your life was worth living right to your face? You seem to have some meager fighting skill. You're bold, though unwise at best, and stupid at worst. Lazmet tapped the tip of his blade against his chin. Your current gift intrigues me, but it is troubling in some respects. Tell me about your marks, boy. The part of Akos that had been stalled like a bad motor started rumbling again. You think you'll know something useful about me based on who I've killed and how? Akos said. What about you? What if I judged your worth based on the fact that your weak-willed son managed to trap you somewhere for 10 seasons? Lazmet's eyes narrowed. My son was coached by his mother into winning the loyalty of some strategically placed soldiers, Lazmet said. The ability to win hearts is not one I have ever possessed, I will admit that now. They kept my imprisonment secret and guarded me faithfully. From a distance, so I couldn't use my gift against them. But the chaos in Voa following my son's murder resulted in a loss of power in some sectors, and I took my opportunity to escape. All my former guards are now dead. I have their eyeballs in a jar to remind me of my own weakness. It was my own failure that resulted in my captivity, not my son's success. He stepped back. Now tell me the names you wear on your arm, boy. No, Akos said. I am getting bored with you, Lazmet said. And trust me, you don't want me to be bored. Even without my current gift, it would be simple for me to kill you. The last life I took was Vas Kuzar's, Akos said. Lazmet nodded. Impressive, Lazmet said. You know, of course, that I can look up his death in the arena records and find out the name you used. He stepped closer again and brought his knife up between them. You must also have realized that waiting for you outside this door are many guards. You will not leave this house alive if you try to leave it. And given how you entered this room, in the dead of night, with a knife, I am hardly going to allow you any freedom within these walls, which means you will be imprisoned here, and I will have ample time to find out everything I need to know about you. I realize all those things, Akos said, but I didn't fight Vas in the arena. I fought him in the chaos while your son died. There's no record of his death anywhere. Lazmet smiled. And you have more than one mark on your arm. How encouraging to realize that you are not a complete idiot. Congratulations, Akos Noavec. You are not boring. Lazmet lurched forward and opened the door before Akos could move an izzet. Armored guards filled the small office. Take him to a secure room, Lazmet said. Don't hurt him for sport. He's my blood. Akos went quietly. Lazmet's hollow expression following him all the way down the hall.
Chapter 38. Syra. I had to leave the relative safety of Shotet exile-occupied Gallo and return to Pokgo for the conversation with Issei Benazit, the one I had promised the Ogryn leaders I would have, in exchange for them delaying our deportation. The immediate future of Shotet, in other words, was resting on my shoulders. Not that I felt any pressure or anything. In Pokgo, in the forest just outside the city limits, was a high tower built into the trunk of a massive tree, the only place where a person could broadcast off-planet. On the journey, I pestered Lucia's assistant for information about why that was possible, why at that location and nowhere else, and all he knew was that there was a soft spot in Agra's atmosphere there. "That a scientific term?" I asked. "Soft spot?" "Obviously not," the man retorted. "Do I look like an atmospheric scientist to you?"
"You look like a person with a brain who lives on this planet," I said. "How is it you aren't curious?"
He didn't have an answer to that, so I got up and walked the perimeter of the ship, pausing at each plant behind glass to scrutinize it. There was the rippled, brain-like fruit that hung heavy from sturdy vines, the cluster of beakish purple leaves that had two rows of teeth just past their edges, the tiny, starburst-shaped fungi that glowed purple and stuck to your skin if you touched it, leaching nutrients from your body. I wondered if, deep in the jungles here, there were plants that had not yet been discovered. How many possibilities were there on this unexplored planet, packed to the brim with the grotesque and the fierce alike? We reached the tower within the day, the ship touching down on a landing pad cradled between two huge branches. I stood just outside the ship, staring at the wide tree with the tower built into its hollowed trunk. I had never seen a plant so large in my life. It was as large in circumference as the taller buildings in Voa, but those had been constructed by our hands, not the buzz of natural life that some said came from the current. I crossed the platform that led from the landing pad to the tower. It swayed a little under my weight, two wires the only things keeping me from toppling over the side. My mouth grew drier with each step, but I forced myself to keep moving. Lucia's assistant gave me a knowing smile as he checked in with the guard by the door. In order to get into the broadcasting room, I had to submit to a brief search. The guard seemed unwilling to touch me, and I didn't reassure her, and climbed several flights of stairs. At the top of the steps, I paused to dab my hairline, now moist with sweat, with the inside of a sleeve, and followed Lucia's assistant in. The broadcast room was abuzz with people, standing at monitors, bent over panels of switches and buttons, plucking pieces of fuzz from the round rug in the middle of the room. Fixed sights, like eyeballs attached to stalks, hung upside down from the ceiling right in the center of the space. The rug was dark and didn't have a pattern. I assumed it was there to dampen the sound, as any reflective surface might have echoed. This was the top floor of the tower, so its windows looked out over the top of the tree, where the huge leaves, bigger than I was, flapped against the glass. They were dark purple, almost black, and trapped in mossy vines.
"Oh, there you are!"
A long-haired Seema with what looked like a wad of cloud in hand said to me. It was the sort of thing a person said to someone they already knew, but I didn't know them, so I stared quizzically until they offered an explanation.
"Wasn't sure whether you knew how to paint your face or not," they said in Otherian. "Looks like all you need is some dust so you don't shine. Good."
They brought the white puffy thing down on my face, and pale dust erupted in a cloud around me, making me sneeze. They held up a mirror so I could see that the powder had made my face matte and even.
"Thank you," I said. Stand on the X, they said. They're hailing the assembly ship now.
Good, I said, though I wasn't sure I believed it was good at all. I was about to talk to a woman who thought I was complicit in the murder of her twin sister, after all. And I was going to ask her to cooperate? Compromise? This was not going to go well. Still, I made my way to the little X on the rug marked with iridescent tape, and looked up at the sights. Someone near the wall tapped a button a few times to lower them, so the sights were at my eye level. A screen lowered in front of me to show me Issei Benazit when she appeared. For now, the screen was a blank white, waiting to be filled with an image. Soon enough, Lucia's assistant was announcing that they had made the connection with Othir and were about to broadcast. He counted down in Othirian, and then Issei Benazit's scarred face flickered to life in front of me. Pain coursed through my hands, intensifying in my knuckles, which felt like they were breaking. I blinked away tears. For a moment, she just stared at me, and I stared back. She looked unwell. She was thinner than she had been when I last saw her, and the skin under her eyes had purpled, even through the layer of makeup she was surely wearing to cover it. Beyond those obvious signs, though, there was something off. There was a wildness to her gaze that hadn't been there the last time she looked at me, like she was about to fly apart. This was the woman who had killed hundreds of my people. A shell of a woman, with flight in her eyes. Chancellor Benazit, I said finally, my jaw tense.
Miss Noavec, she replied, in a clipped, formal voice that didn't quite belong to her. I suppose I shouldn't say sovereign, since your own people can't agree on one, can they?
I decided not to tell her that even the exiles didn't want me as a leader, that they called me Oruzo, successor, that they blamed me for all the people she had killed, that I was only standing here to correct some of my own mistakes. But I felt those truths pulsing inside me like another heart. I was no sovereign.
I said, "My people are divided, as you would know if you regarded us with any decency at all. As for my legitimacy, I am one of two viable heirs to the sovereignty. You may feel free to deal with the other one if you'd prefer it."
She looked at me for a moment, almost as if she was considering it. But her resignation was evident on her face. Much as she hated me, I was the only supposed Noavec who offered either of our nations hope for peace. Bolstered by that confidence, I straightened. Issei cleared her throat and said,
"I agreed to this call because I was assured you had a worthwhile offer for me to consider. I suggest you make it before I decide this is not worth my time."
"I'm not here to beg at your feet," I snapped. "If you'd rather continue down your path of rampant destruction, there's really nothing I can say to stop you, so..."
"My path of rampant destruction," she said, with a mirthless laugh,
and then another, longer peal of laughter.
"Hundreds of my people were killed by my father and his loyalists," I said loudly. "Not by me. Not by any of the people here." "And in his place, you would have done what?" she snapped. "You forget. I've met you, Syra Noavec. I know your talent for diplomacy. I would have selected a military target in accordance with our galaxy's laws," I said. "Of course, I would also have waited to negotiate reasonable peace terms instead of hitting hundreds of fleeing refugees with advanced Pithar weaponry."
"I didn't know there were refugees on board," she said, her voice suddenly hushed. I had thought, once, that Issei reminded me of shale, hard and jagged. And she was shale now, too, easily broken into fragments. A shudder went through her before she went on, as if that broken moment hadn't happened at all.
"I offered you terms of surrender, as you recall," she said. "You refused them." "What you offered," I said, my voice trembling with rage, "was insulting and disrespectful, and you knew full well we would not accept it."
I stared into the sight instead of at her image on the screen, though I could see her stony expression just beyond its eye.
"Your offer, Miss Noavec," she said finally. "What I want is for you to drop this request for the Ogryns to kick us off their planet, which would force seasons-old enemies of Lazmet Noavec to return to a war zone," I snapped. "And in return, I will kill him."
"Why am I not surprised that the solution you propose involves murder?" she said dryly.
"The originality of your insults is truly stunning," I said.
"Without Lazmet to lead them, his faction of soldiers will be easily subdued by us. The exiles will seize control of Xotet, and we can negotiate a peace instead of killing each other." She closed her eyes. She had gone to great lengths to look older than she was, I noticed, just as I had. She wore a jacket cut in the traditional Hessian style, black and buttoned diagonally across her chest, finishing at the side of her throat. Her hair was pulled back tight, throwing the angles of her face into sharp relief. The scars, too, gave her a maturity that most people at our age didn't have. They said she had survived something, endured something she never should have had to. But despite all those things, she was young. She was young, and wanted all this to stop. Even if she never understood what she had done to me, to my people. At least we both had that. We wanted this to stop.
"I have to take action," she said, opening her eyes. "My advisors, my people, my allies demand it."
"Then just give me time," I said. "A few weeks." She shook her head.
"The Shissa hospital fell from the sky," she said. "People who needed help, people who..."
She choked and stopped. "I didn't do that," I said, firm. "We didn't do that." I realized, too late, that maybe now wasn't the time to insist on my own innocence. Maybe I could have gone further with some sympathy.
"But she destroyed the Sojourn ship. She attacked us. She deserves wrath.
But maybe I would do better with mercy."
"1 week," she said. "That gives you 3 days after you've made the journey from Agra to Thuva."
"1 week," I repeated, "to get from Agra to Urek, plan an assassination, and carry it out. Are you mad?"
"No," she replied simply. "That's my offer, Miss Noavec. I suggest you take it."
And if I had been softer, kinder, perhaps her offer would have been more generous. But I was who I was.
"Fine," I said. "I'll send you a message when it's done."
And I walked right out of frame.
Chapter 39 Seezy. Otherians have soft hands. That's the first thing I notice. Soft hands and soft bodies. The woman who greets us at the elegant apartments where we'll be staying for this short visit carries more weight around her hips and thighs than most Thuvazit women. Something about it appeals to me. I wonder what it would feel like to touch a body with so much give. Judging by the look she gives me, she's wondering something similar about me. I don't look like a Hesse girl, really. Most people from Hesse work the ice flower farms or do some other kind of hard labor, so they're muscled and lean. I'm built more like the people in Shissa, where I went to school. Narrow, with a store of flesh around the waist. For the colder months, people sometimes joked. Most of those people are dead now. The Otherian tells us, in an unctuous voice, where we'll go for dinner, and what our attire should be like. I very nearly exchange a look with Ast at that. And then I remember he can't see it, and likely wouldn't want to share a moment like that with me anyway. Still, I do put on my formal gown for dinner, the one formal thing I own. It's in the Hessian style, which means it looks almost like a military uniform on top, buttoning across my heart from shoulder to ribs. It's tailored tight to my body, down to my waist, and then flows in a softer skirt to the floor. The color is crimson, hush flower red for luck. In the hallway, Ast fusses with the buttons on his cuffs. They're small and made of glass, slippery. I don't think much about it when I take his wrist in mine and do them up for him. I'm surprised he lets me, though.
She told me I'm being too rough on you, he says to me, his voice hard.
The beetle he uses to guide him flies a fast circle around my head and shoulders, close enough to skim my clothes with its little legs, clicking all the while. Did she? I say, flat, grabbing his other wrist.
The thing is,
he seizes my hand suddenly and holds me fast, too hard, leaning close so I can smell something sharp on his breath.
I don't think I am, CZ. I think you're too clever, too motivated, and too sweet.
I finish up with his buttons and walk away without responding. There's not much to say, really. Issei waits near the doors where the Otherian woman said she'd meet us. Issei turns, and the sight of her hits me hard, like I've run right into it. Her eyelids are traced with perfect black lines, her lips stained a faint pink. Her hair is pulled back tight and shines like polished glass. She is dressed in the Ozark style, a body-skimming underlayer, dark blue, with loose fabric draped over it, giving hints of her hips' curves when it presses here or there. Wow, I say to her. She rolls her eyes a little, doing a quick slashing gesture with one of her fingers to point out the scars that cross her face. I notice them, of course, every time I look at her, but to me they don't detract from her beauty. They are just distinct, like a birthmark or a dusting of freckles. I lean in to touch my lips to the one above her eyebrow. Still wow, I say. And you, she says, glancing at Ast. Ast, you have never looked more uncomfortable.
Then I look how I feel, he says stiffly.
The doors slide open in front of us, and standing just beyond them is the Otherian woman from earlier. I don't remember her name. Most Otherian names have at least three syllables, which means I forget them right away. We follow her to a floater that hovers near the edge of the balcony. It's different from the ones back home, more like an enclosed platform than an actual vehicle. We stand together inside it, and the woman, Cardenzia? Something with a Zia, I think, pilots us, by which I mean she presses a button and we zoom toward a pre-programmed destination. The floater doesn't shake or jolt at all, just glides over manicured parks and past gleaming buildings. It lifts us through a layer of wispy clouds, then pauses by a loading dock. I'm not sure what else to call it, though I've never seen a loading dock so fancy in my life. It's also enclosed, since we're high up, and the floors are reflective black tile, as if heavy spacecraft don't have to land on top of them all the time. Cardenzia, as I've now decided to call her, leads us across the empty dock to a maze of wide hallways, lined with portraits of former Otherian leaders, or framed flags of all the Otherian provinces. Doormen wearing black gloves open a set of gilded double doors for us at the end of one such hallway. I thought I was ready for more Otherian extravagance, but I have to stop and stare in awe in the next room. Someone cultivated a garden inside this place. Above us, the sunset light glows through skylights, casting orange-tinted streaks on the dark leaves of vines that wrap around chair legs and creep across the edges of the table. Trees stand in a line on one side of the room, their leaves dark purple and blue, with lighter veins running through them. Strings of light hang from the ceiling. Their actual strings are near invisible, creating the illusion of glowing orbs that hang like falling raindrops in midair all over the room. A woman comes over to greet us. I know by the circlet of gold atop her head that she is a ruler of Othir, and her name falls right out of my head, like my manners. A man follows her, wearing a similar circlet, and another man behind him. All three have even skin and perfect hair and white teeth. The men have facial hair that looks like it was drawn on with a fine-tipped pen. Welcome to Othir, the woman says, smiling that white, white smile. Chancellor Benazit, it is a pleasure to meet you at last. Is this your first time visiting our beautiful planet? Yes, it is, Issei replies. Thank you for hosting us, Councilwoman Harth. These are my advisors, CZ Karaseth and Ast. Ast? No surname? Councilwoman Harth says.
No need for surnames in the Brim, Ast replies. Not like we're keeping track of dynasties or anything, Your Grace.
The Brim, one of the men bellows. How charming. This must be quite different for you, then.
Plates are plates, whether they're shiny or not, Ast replies.
It's the most I've ever liked him.
My name is Councilman Sharva, the shorter of the two men says. His hair is black, his mustache curled at the ends. He has a big nose, perfectly straight and narrow through the bridge.
And this is Councilman Shezel. The three of us are in charge of interplanetary cooperation and aid.
They want us to use their surnames, then. I guess that's what makes this a business meeting instead of a casual get-together. He continues.
And you, CZ, are you also from the Brim?
A woman wearing the same black gloves as the man who opened the doors earlier passes out small glasses of something I don't recognize. It smells sharp and tangy. I wait for the Otherians to drink before I do, so I can see how they manage it. They take dainty sips from the glasses, which are only large enough to be pinched between two fingers. They are etched with swirling designs. No, I say. I'm from Hessa, on Thuva.
Karaseth, was it?
Councilwoman Harth addresses me. Where have I heard that name before? My family line is faded, I say, and my mother is the sitting oracle of Thuva. Everybody goes quiet. Even the woman with the tray of glasses, empty now, pauses to look at me before leaving the room. I know Otherians don't revere the oracles, but I didn't know being related to one was such a scandal.
Oh, Harth says, lips pursed. You must have had a very interesting upbringing.
I smile, even though my heartbeat is picking up speed. I won't panic. If anyone can make these people love the daughter of an oracle, it's me. Speaking to my mother is a little like trying to grab hold of a fish, I say. I love her dearly, of course, but I am always relieved to talk with people who are not allergic to specificity. Shuzzle laughs, at least, and I send them all a feeling as fine as the softest fabric gliding over them. I'd be surprised if it didn't work. Otherians irritate me, but they're not complicated. They're not guarded against people like me. People with gentle voices and titles like advisor.
So, you are not a fanatic, then? Shezel says. That is a relief. I was not looking forward to hearing discussion of how we ought to elevate the Oracle's position instead of overseeing them.
I want to tell him to eat shit. I want to tell him that having my entire community find out I was destined to get sliced or stabbed someday was a nightmare. That the Assembly's policy of transparency was the reason my brothers got kidnapped and my father killed. But my current gift won't let me, and I don't really try to force it. They want me to be docile and sweet, so that's what I'll be. And if Ast glares at me the whole time, well, that's just another thing to ignore.
You just appeared as if from nowhere, my dear, Hearth says to Issei. Where did your family stash you away?
On a pirate ship, Issei says. Hearth laughs, a tinkling laugh.
Shezel comes toward me, and I see the strategy. Sharva is angled toward Ast. Hearth is tackling Issei, and Shezel is on me. They are splitting us up so we can't help each other. For what purpose, I don't know.
What do you think of Othir so far? Shezel asks me.
I sip my drink. It's well constructed, I say.
Whatever do you mean?
It's designed to dazzle, and it does, I say. I come from a place where beauty is harder to see. My eyes are trained to search for it. But here, I guess I can give my eyes a rest.
I have never been to Thuva, I confess, Shezel says. Is it as cold as they say?
Colder than that, I say, especially in Hessa, where I am from.
Ah, Hessa, he says, the very heart of Thuva. Is that not what they call it?
He says the phrase, the very heart of Thuva, in labored but accurate Thuvazit. I smile. But you must know the rest of the quote. He shakes his head. Hessa is a land of ill-mannered, poorly groomed, inarticulate dirt lovers who spit on their hands to wash them, I say. Yet, it is the very heart of Thuva. Shezel pauses for a tick, then lets out a loud guffaw. In the pause, I angle my head toward Issei to catch some of her conversation with Hearth. Hearth is offering condolences for the attack against Shissa, asking for details.
Do you find that to be accurate?
Shezel asks me. Oh, I don't know, I say airily. Sometimes we use water to wash our hands, in the warmer months. Shezel laughs again. I try again to hear what Hearth is saying to Issei, but her voice is too quiet, more like a murmur. I'm working so hard to pay attention to her that I keep forgetting about my gift, and I can feel the tension in the room rising like a temperature nobody else can feel but me.
I meant, Shezel says, voice a little harder now. Do you find Hessa to be a backward place? You are the child of an oracle, after all.
I'm not sure I understand the connection, I say with some effort. If he gets more antagonistic, I won't be able to talk at all. I'll just stand here with my mouth opening and closing like a fish.
Simply that oracles are a relic of the past, not a reflection of our present,
he says.
People on Othir make their own destinies. Their importance is determined by their industry, not their possession of a fate.
None of your fellow counselors are from fated families, I say. One of his eyes twitches at the corner.
On the contrary, our elected representative is Councilwoman Hearth's cousin. Her segment of the Hearth family was not favored by fate, as they say.
He says,
that man's fate is not a guarantee of his worth or his fitness, but traditions do take some time to die.
I nod. I understand now. Councilwoman Hearth wants to be in power, but power was given to her cousin instead. She blames it on his fate. And maybe she's right. Or maybe he really was the one for the job. I'll never know. But either way, she's jealous. And it sounds like Shezel is, too. That must have been difficult for Councilwoman Hearth, I say. as one who seeks to influence, to have that position granted to another in her family.
There is still time for everyone to get what they deserve,
Shezel says. A bell rings on the far side of the room, signaling us to go to the table for dinner. The gilded plates have place cards on top of them. Issei and I have Hearth between us, but Issei plucks Hearth's card from its place and swaps it for mine, with a smile. She reaches for my hand, folding our fingers together. It's a clear signal that we are together, but it's also an excuse to change the seating, I'm sure. I play along, my smile shy and my gaze lowered. We sit, leaves framing our shoulders and lights dancing above our heads. A line of servants emerge from a hidden door on the far side of the room, covered with ivy, and carry plates to us. It's like a dance, all their movements synchronized. I wonder if they have to practice it. I forgot to ask, Chancellor, if you or your advisors would like to take advantage of Othir's excellent doctors while you are here. We offer complimentary health screenings to our distinguished guests, Hearth says, as if I am a window between them instead of a body. Subpar as Thuva's doctors may be, Issei says, voice hard. We'll pass. Thanks. Her accent is starting to leak into her trained voice, which I know she hates. I split my focus, sending water toward her and wrapping the others in finery. I have to press hard to feel the tension in the room give, but give it does. Ast glances at me. I don't know if Issei... Oh, I mean, Chancellor Benazid. I pause, letting myself blush. A nice show for the Othirians. I don't know if Chancellor Benazid told you, Councilwoman Hearth, but I was in school to be a chemist before I was Her Highness's advisor. I am reasonably good at preparing ice flowers for medicine. Are you? Hearth says, sounding bored. How fascinating. My research was in the area of breaking down ice flowers to their basic compounds, I say, layering a heavy, rich fabric over Hearth in particular. She appears to need more of my current gift, which I am certain would be useful to Othir, since it relies on us so heavily for its most potent ingredients. Yes, Issei says. I assume you have still been unsuccessful in cultivating ice flowers here on Othir? We have, in fact, Hearth says. It seems they will only grow on your planet. It's very strange. Ah, well, Thuva is an odd little place, always changing, I say. We are so flattered that you have taken an interest in us. Issei glances at me sidelong, like she's not sure what I'm angling at. I let my comment dangle, awkward, between Hearth and me. Of course, Hearth says. We only wish to offer our support.
What do you mean when you say support?
Ast asks. And for once, I'm glad he's here. He can ask the questions my current gift won't let me ask.
Sorry, he says, propping his elbows up on the edge of the table. I'm no good with manners, or whatever. When I want to know something, I just ask it.
An admirable quality, Ast, Hearth says. It's probably a dig at me, and it stings. Our intention was actually to ask Chancellor Benazid what Thuva needs in this struggle against Shotet. We have a great deal of resources at our disposal. Ast looks at Issei and shrugs.
Weapons,
he says. Ast. Issei says his name like a warning. We haven't agreed that's necessary yet.
I mean, go ahead and dither all you want, Issei, he says, but eventually we're gonna need to fight back. Pitha gave us one anti-current blast, and we could use another to start. Better ships too, probably, since Thuva's are out of date and slow, and can't even carry the damn weapon.
Hearth laughs. Shezel and Sharva join in.
Well, Shezel says, those requests don't sound too difficult to grant, do they, Councilwoman?
No, she replies with a smile. We will be happy to give you what you need, provided Chancellor Benazit agrees.
Well, I'd prefer it if my advisors would handle things with more delicacy, Issei says sharp. Thuva does need to protect itself. It would be helpful to have another long-distance weapon to use against Shotet, to keep from having to fight a war on land or in the sky. As a last resort, you understand. Their combat skills are quite advanced, as we all know, and none of our ships are equipped to make use of such a weapon.
Then it is settled, Shezel says, picking up his glass.
My throat feels tight. I strain against it, fighting to make a sound, any sound. Finally, the only thing I can think to do is to knock my fist against the table. I squeeze Issei's hand, tightly, hard enough to crack her knuckles.
Wait a moment, Issei says. Cece's current gift unfortunately prevents her from speaking freely in some situations, and she clearly has something to say.
Thank you, I manage. I am curious about something.
What's that, dear?
Harth says. I don't like her tone.
It makes me feel about an is-it tall. My father told me not to trust any deal where one person gains more than the other, I say. I raise my eyebrow. I can't quite ask the question, but I feel like I've gotten close enough.
That is a good point, Issei says quietly. What will Othir expect in return for its generosity?
Is the defeat of a galaxy-wide pest not enough of a reward? Harth says.
I shake my head.
There's no precedent for this level of cooperation between us, Issei says. We maintain a neutral relationship because we depend on each other for the good of both Othirians and Thuvazites. But we often find ourselves on different sides of particular issues, yes, Harth says.
Most notably, Sharva says, speaking for the first time. His voice is a rumble, but thin, no richness to it. Most notably in the decision to release the fates of the favored lines to the public.
Yes, Issei says tersely. A decision that affected my planet disproportionately, as we are possessed of not one, but three favored families.
Nonetheless, Othir stands behind its decision, Sharva says, and wishes to press for even greater oversight of the oracles moving forward.
Ast sits back. His face is unreadable, but he doesn't seem uncomfortable to me. I guess I always just assumed he didn't like me because of my current gift. But maybe it's my Oracle Mother, too. Maybe he's on Othir's side in this whole thing.
And you want Thuva's support, I say, in exchange for weapons.
It's clear to me now what the Oracle Vara meant. Don't trust the Othirians. Don't let her agree to it, whatever you do. This has to be the it she was talking about. A promise of support.
We would hope that giving Thuva support now would encourage you to rethink your position on the oracles, Sharva clarifies. We know that Thuva is not an overly fate-faithful nation-planet, that it, too, wishes to embrace the future of this galaxy and set it up for success rather than failure.
What kind of oversight of the oracles are you talking about? Issei says.
We simply want to be aware of what the oracles discuss and what plans they are making, given the future they see unfolding, Harth says. They make decisions on a regular basis that affect all of us. We wish to know what those decisions are. We wish to have access to the information that they possess.
I feel quiet, not unlike the way I feel when Akos holds my hand. Like all the current has gone still around me. In the past few weeks, I saw my own mom manipulate Akos into killing someone, just because she wanted the man gone. I saw her let my oldest friend die when she probably could have prevented it. She says those actions were for the greater good. But what if we don't agree on what that greater good is?
Should she get to decide without anybody looking over her shoulder? Even the warning the Oracle Vara gave me is manipulation. What future is Vara trying for? Is she working for my best interest? Or Thuva's? Or Agra's? Or the Oracle's? Don't let her agree to it. Should I listen? Or no? I chew on the inside of my cheek. Who will be able to access this information? Anyone who wants it? Issei asks. The wide release of the Fates didn't turn out well for many on my planet. It will be limited, of course, to the Assembly, Parth says. We do not want to endanger the public. Issa's head bobs slowly. I'd like some time to talk this over with my advisors, Issei says, if you don't mind. Of course, Parth says. Let us eat and move to lighter topics. We can talk in the morning, when you have made your decision. Issei inclines her head, agreeing. Chapter 40 Sizi.
Not sure why we even need to talk about this, asked Sez gruffly.
We are in Issei's temporary quarters on Othir. He stands against a wall of light, a window so wide and clean it doesn't seem to be there at all. The sun is setting behind Othir's glass buildings, the light refracting a dozen times over, so the whole city sparkles orange. Right when we got here, Ast unbuttoned his cuffs, so now they flap around his wrists whenever he gestures. I sigh and rub my temples with both hands. For all that Ast pretends to be a low-class mechanic from the Brim, he's not a fool. He knows this isn't some simple exchange. Otherian aid in exchange for a promise. It's a tipping point for what kind of nation we're going to be. Enemies of Othir, or enemies of the Oracles. And then there's the issue of the weapons. I just promised Syra Noavec time before we pushed Agra for Shotet deportation, Issei says. And now you want me to pursue an aggressive response instead of a diplomatic one? That's why we need to talk about it.
Diplomacy? Asked Snorts. Did Shotet go for a diplomatic solution in Shissa?
The room is already so tense I can't talk. I feel it like the humid air in a greenhouse, filling my mouth. I tried to counter it with a clumsy press of my current gift, sending the feeling of water everywhere, like an overturned bucket. Ast's mouth twists with disgust, and I pull back a little. Setting aside the issue of weaponry for a moment, I say gently, there is also the issue of Oracle oversight.
I don't give a shit if Othir wants to keep an eye on the Oracles, Ast says. Why do you?
That's the problem. That Othir will keep an eye on them and not anyone else, Issei says. You don't know these people like I do. Othir exerts an extraordinary amount of control over the Assembly. If the information gleaned from Oracle oversight is only released to the Assembly, it is essentially giving Othir control over the Fates instead of the Oracles, which is only trading one problem for another.
You're being indecisive, Ast says. You've been like this since we were kids. You don't want to do something unless you can practically guarantee its outcome.
I open my mouth, but nothing comes out. Not a word, not a sound. Issei is too focused on Ast to notice me struggling. Don't let her, Vara's voice says in my mind. What the hell am I supposed to do to stop her? I ask her in my head. I can't even talk. I asked you to come here because I thought you would keep me honest, she says to Ast. But you have to acknowledge that you don't have experience with all this.
It's because I don't have experience that I can make it clear for you, he says, moving closer.
Water, water, I think. I remember sinking to the bottom of the warm pool in the temple when Mom taught me to swim. How pleasant the light pressure of water around my head had been. a gentle squeeze.
I don't know politics. It's true, he says more quietly now. But I know Shotet, Issei. We both do.
He touches the tips of his fingers to the screwdriver he keeps at his side instead of a knife.
They took my family from me, he said. And they took your family from you. They promised a peaceful scavenge, and then resorted to murder and theft. That is who they are.
He holds out his hands, palms up, and she places hers on top of them, letting him squeeze her fingers gently.
You promised to give Novavec a week before acting. You didn't promise what action you would take, he says.
He's created a kind of bubble around them, and I am not inside it.
If she can't kill Lazmet Novavec, you will have to act, and deportation of Shotet exiles won't be enough. Remember the names? The names you've been reciting?
Issei blinks tears from her eyes.
So many people, she says.
Yes, he says. Too many people. It can't happen again, Issei. You can't let it.
My face is hot with anger. He is preying on her grief, her sorrow for the loss Thuva suffered, as well as the loss she herself suffered. She hasn't been right since Ori's death. She's drowning in hurt, and he is taking advantage of that.
We need stronger weapons, he says. We can't engage in a land war with the Shotet because we'll die. I know supporting Othir might lead to something you don't like, but you won't even get the chance to fight that battle if you don't win this one.
She's nodding at Ast when I slip out of the room. I have to do something about this, and if my current gift won't let me talk, I'll have to do it another way. Making contact with Agra isn't difficult. It's just a matter of finding Cardenzia. I wait until evening settles into night, before seeking her out. I touch her arm, gentle, as I explain that my mom is on Agra visiting the Agran Oracle, and I want to make sure she's all right. I keep my smile wide, and I use my current gift to wrap her in fine fabric, the kind that slides over your skin. I must be getting stronger with all this practice, because she relaxes right away under its influence, and leads me to the communication tower. Her secure code gets me access to the satellite, and I gush my gratitude, with another touch of cloth. I sit in the broadcasting chair, which is metal with a rigid back, to keep people from fidgeting while they send their messages. The room is full of technicians, but it doesn't matter. They don't speak Thuvazit. Othirians learn more common languages, like Pithar or Trellin, not our silky, windswept tongue.
This message is for Syra Novavec, I say to the site, capturing my face and voice. Issei Benazit is considering aggressive action. Othir intends to make a play against the Oracles, and they have requested Thuva's support in exchange for weapons. She's grieving. She's desperate. We all are. And at the heart of her, I don't think she'll ever believe the word of a Shotet.
I look down.
You can't fail, I say. Kill Lazmet Novavec. Don't fail. Transmission complete.
I tap the screen in front of me to begin compressing the recording into the smallest possible data file. The Agran satellite ship delivers data to Agra's surface once a day, so Syra will receive it by tomorrow, if she's going to see it at all.
What was that?
It's asked. I use the hard back of the chair to steady my hands when I get to my feet. I don't know how much of my message he heard. I brush off my skirt and turn toward him. He's disheveled, like he ran here, the beetle buzzing in a quick circle around his head before it coasts around the perimeter of the room and flies a tight circle around my body. His eyes are unfocused and stationary, as always, but his brow is furrowed.
because it sounded like you were giving our enemies confidential information about Thuva's negotiations with Othir.